Welcome to Founders Unfiltered by your junior VC. We are your hosts, Mazen and Aviral. Aviral, when a founder is starting, should they have an exit mindset? Is that something they should be factoring into their decisions?
Very good question. Very interesting question. Investors have obviously an eye on if a business is exitable, as to how would this company either go public or get transacted. I think if a founder builds with an exit mindset, on the other hand, it's probably disastrous. I've never seen it actually play out well, because business building for a founder at least is not as limited term as an investor, right? I wouldn't say a VC has a short term horizon, but yeah, you know, a 7 to 10 year outlook versus a founder's outlook, which will be much longer, is obviously shorter term, right? Zuckerberg has been the CEO of Facebook for, I think, 2 decades now, but a lot of his early investors must have exited the company. So if a founder has an exit mindset, that means the founder will optimize for the short term, not the long term. In general, what that tends to show in behavior is the founder optimizes for things like getting personal liquidity very quickly, taking decisions that enhance that, kind of giving up when the company is not showing a clear path to an exit. And I think you need to have a greater passion as well as a greater goal than just a monetary incentive, which obviously is important, but if that's the sole goal, then it's very hard to scale a company. So in general, if I, you know, at least as an investor, I see founders talking about an exit in our first conversation as a seed investor, I generally see it as a negative and a red flag.
In this episode of Founders Unfiltered, we speak to Abhinav, the co-founder of Perpule. Abhinav grew up in a traditional middle-class family and went on to college to study engineering. Becoming a part of the Institute's entrepreneurship cell, he got exposed to the world of startups. Interacting with founders and hearing about their experiences, he realized that ultimately, he too wants to become a founder one day. After graduation, he got a high-paying job at Goldman Sachs. And after working for a few months in the Indian office, he went to work in the US, where he met his co-founder. The two loved discussing product ideas and studying emerging market trends. While living in the US, they witnessed the Black Friday sale and were awestruck. Everyone goes on massive shopping sprees, with items getting out of stock in a matter of hours. The observation made them interested in the Indian space. Amidst the Flipkart-Amazon rivalry, they were confident that offline retail also had an important role to play. Digging further into the Indian retail space revealed its inefficiencies and presented the large opportunity at hand. Wanting to get their best shot at the problem, they both quit their jobs and came back to India. And that's how Perpule was born. Join us to learn how Abhinav built Perpule with the vision of taking Indian commerce online.
Thanks a lot, Abhinav, for agreeing to do this. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Same here. Thanks a lot for having me.
So Abhinav, would love to learn a little bit more about your journey in the early days. Maybe, you know, where you grew up, the influences it had on the decisions you made. Then, you know, you went up in college, worked for a couple of years and then started Perpule. I would love to understand that journey, if you could talk through it. And maybe, you know, talk about where your entrepreneurial journey started taking shape and form, right? And what was the thought process behind that?
Sure, absolutely. Cool. Thanks for that question. So I was born in Lucknow, lived there for a good chunk of my life. Most of my schooling, etc., was from Lucknow. Then towards the end of my schooling, last couple of years, just moved to Delhi, lived there for a while. And then in parallel, got an admission to NIT Suratkal for engineering. So like the typical IIT prep sort of a mindset is where the journey really started from. That's probably the first thing that I tried to do, although failed at it, but ended up getting an equivalent, decent top tier in IT. That's how, I mean, mainstream life started. And that was in Karnataka. So came to campus. This is back in what, 2011 is when I finished my, you can say, schooling, and then moved to NIT Suratkal for engineering. And post that, I've been in Bangalore for almost a bit more than 6 years now. So that's pretty much the geography. I've been to a lot of places. I've like relatives all over India, primarily not a good chunk in South as well, but have lived only in these three cities actually, and love Delhi and Bangalore like a lot, and I'm a big fan of Bombay as well, although never lived there, but have traveled a lot because of work. And I think journey in college is the most interesting pieces well. Although even before that, I got a pretty good sense of, can say, aspiration from a lot of guys. I mean, a good chunk of my school seniors also went on to build businesses, etc., which I look back at now and kind of talk to about is pretty interesting. But that's not where the whole entrepreneurship piece started. Actually started in college. And like, this is one thing that I quote, right? Before my first year in college, I had no idea. I never really gave that a thought that any individual can start a business, right? What is a business? Who starts a business? What does a business at scale look like? I never even gave a thought like that. But when I came to college, there were like tons of clubs, and there was an ECL entrepreneurship cell basically, which was quite active. And a good chunk of NITK entrepreneurs, right? Like if you look at them, Taxi for Sure, Raghu, Practo, Shashank, and then like tons of others were kind of once in a while, at least once in 6 months, once a year, would drop either through a video call or in person at college and kind of inspire a big bunch of mass of people. So I used to be in those in first year. Got a very good inspiration from all of them. And that's where it really struck to me that, I mean, after pursuing the ECL activities for a good 5-6 months, it kind of triggered to me and felt that this is something that I really relate to. And then that's when, I mean, looking at the experiences, goods, bad, successes, failures, the odds of success in entrepreneurship, it kind of became clear towards the, you can say, early or second year in my college that at some point I would want to be an entrepreneur. So this was quite clear back then. And then I kind of started pursuing more, got in touch with a lot more folks, etc. Again, that was not a priority. At some point means it can happen anytime in life, right? In college, there are other priorities. You have to chill a lot. And then like placements, etc., were what I personally really focused on. And I was in mechanical engineering. That was the other drain on me. 1 year into college, I understood that, look, mechanical engineering is not anything remotely I would want to do in life. So then building a parallel career in computer science, took electives. So that self was taking some amount of time. So focused on that, got a computer science related job at Goldman. And after that whole thing, this is what early, like probably fifth or sixth day into my final year in college, got the pre-placement offer from Goldman Sachs. And that's when I understood that, look, the base is now covered and this is time to aim bigger. And that's when I took entrepreneurship very seriously. I've been kind of doing multiple bunch of experiments, multiple small scale within college projects, etc., with seniors. So I think a lot of learnings were per se coming, but I knew all of them were like once in a while gigs and none of them were really serious businesses that would evolve from there. So I did them for learning purposes. But post I had a pre-placement offer from college, kind of started talking about entrepreneurship a lot more seriously and decided that maybe in a few years down the line, I will want to do it. And again, few years meaning like a single digit, 5-6 years is when I would want to pursue entrepreneurship and not in my 40s. That became more and more clear. And thankfully, NITK has a very, very good set of seniors who are quite active. If you want to reach out to them, they would love to speak with you. So I think got in touch with all of them, understood a lot more about the realities, the harsh realities rather of the business. I mean, how to build it from ground up, what is the life cycle? Because a good chunk of like building a business, building a startup, right, is a pretty repeatable process. Like you can draw parallels and it's a solved problem. So I think good to get all of that knowledge. And then post, I mean, this is how finally in college really went on. Post that, started working at Goldman. I worked there only for a very small stint of 14 months, in which for almost 6 months, I was in the US. They have a pretty nice program where they send their new hires for a global integration program to New York in the Goldman Sachs headquarters. So I was there, I mean, half the time I was in the US. And that's where I got to gel with a lot more people. And this is something that I kind of keep telling people, right? I think your companies are the best places to find your co-founders. So that kind of happened to me as well. Saket, who is my co-founder and CTO at Purple, was my colleague at Goldman. We traveled to US together. The third co-founder, Yogesh, was my college junior. So, I mean, your co-founders generally come from your very, very immediate adjacent network and kind of activities that are happening in your life. So thanks to Goldman for that. And then I think the three of us kind of got together very well. And towards the end of 2015 is when all of us had the similar aspiration in life to really build a business, but had no idea where to start. So things kind of kept happening and we were not really forcing that. Even if we don't get a good idea, we don't get a good, you can say, guidance on what we really want to do, we will not start. So we were clear on that. So I did a lot of research, a lot of industries, a lot of markets. Currently, interesting activity happened in the US. I witnessed Black Friday. That's like the largest offline shopping festival that happens in the US. And people really go berserk. They just shop the hell out of their lives, right? And those particular, it's a week-long festival in the US and massive chaos across these stores. I kind of happened to witness it firsthand in US and kind of was really, you can say, surprised how bad shopping can become. And again, talking about top tier shopping, right? Experience at a Walmart, Macy's, JCPenney, etc. How bad can it become in a developed country like US. And that's when it triggered. I kind of built back the experience. I thought if there's a shopping experience, a festival like this in India, what will happen? People will really like kill each other, right? I mean, the kind of crowd that we can have in the stores is scary. So that's when the thought process really started. And then we kind of started learning about retail because none of us were like just non-shopaholics at all. We would go to a store for the bare minimum necessities. So it was not a natural thought process that we would look for problems in a store. But accidentally, that kind of happened. Then we started reading about retail. A few things that we had learned back in college, right? That you should have a large market. You should have a good, you can say, scope. You should have a lot of people so that you can build a large business. So all of those basics of building a large business were aligning very well in the favor of retail. It kind of accounted for 12% of GDP, employed 9% of India's workforce. So it was a large market. So it seemed like a good starting point. Kept deep diving into it to understand a pain point. And over, you can say, what, while still at Goldman, did some good 6-7 months of research and concluded on a pain point that checkout lines in a retail store are pretty bad and it's a pretty broken experience. So maybe a good starting point to fix. And this is all pre-Amazon Go. So I think Amazon Go was announced in, I think, November of 2016. This was, you can say, July, August of 2016. So just a few months before that, and had no idea that a company like Amazon would be working on something like Amazon Go. So that later happened to be a very good validation. So when we kind of understood that this is an interesting problem to solve is when me and Saket quit our jobs from Goldman to start pursuing this full time. Yogesh was still in college. So he kind of used to come to Bangalore, with us, and the three of us got together to start building a solution for the problem of lines at retail store.
Interesting. That's very cool. So your origin story basically was, you know, stumbling across a problem, going deeper into it, and then realizing that it's a very big problem and you want to really go after it. What made you take the leap, which is a very difficult decision that a lot of people have to go through, right? What was the thought process there? What were your concerns and considerations?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I don't think there's a right answer. Probably it's different for everyone. But for me, I think it was the sheer persistence, right? I mean, I was really passionate about entrepreneurship. I really imbibed, I really looked upon as like successful entrepreneurs as heroes. And luckily at the same point, right, there was a lot of noise in the ecosystem, right? Flipkart versus Amazon. I think Ola had acquired Taxi for Sure. Practo was scaling beautifully. So I think there were a lot of, you can say, startup poster boys. Per se, Vijay Shekhar Sharma was like riding on a beautiful payments wave, was owning the payments ecosystem completely. So I think that kind of gave a lot of inspiration. And because all of these are very normal guys, right? They're as good as I would have been. You never compare yourself with a Mukesh Ambani, but you can think of comparing yourself with a Bhavesh Agarwal or a and any other like startup founder. So the stories were a lot more relatable. I think that is what gave me the inspiration. And you can say the sheer confidence that it's worth a shot. We may succeed, we may not succeed, that's secondary. But it's totally worth a shot. And what is at stake, right, is nothing. I mean, what 12 months into, 14 months into corporate, we understood that it's really easy to find a corporate job. So even if we say fail, burn 15, 18, 24 months of our lives, that's okay. That's not the end of it. We'll find another job and get back to it. So I think that was the thought process in my mind, very clear with that. Although that's not the same for Saket and Yogesh. Take me a good amount of time to convince them on this approach. But I think eventually over a period of a couple of months of discussions, the three of us aligned quite well on this.
Our topic for this week's episode is taking Indian commerce online. So wanted to dive a bit into your journey. So when you started, there were a whole variety of challenges to face with. You also mentioned that Amazon Go was just around the corner. So can you talk through some of those early challenges and how you address them?
Sure, absolutely. And I think that is the premise, right? I mean, Amazon and Flipkart were scaling at unprecedented pace. And this is back in 2015, 2016, right? There was a debate and a pretty interesting one that would offline stores even exist or would they just die down to the massive scale at which Amazons of the world are kind of scaling? We always felt that, look, they are a very critical contributor to countries' GDP and a very, very successful business model. They would not just die down overnight like this. They may have their ups and downs. Every industry goes through those cycles. But and I think it's by that time we had spoken to enough number of CXOs at these retail chains, right? So we understood that, look, these guys are having a threat. The threat is real. There's no point denying it, no point living in denial. But the threat is fairly solvable, right? I mean, the industry has a threat today because they are really backward in technology, right? A player like Amazon has just built a new way of shopping completely ground up, like fully on technology, and is able to scale very massively. But that doesn't mean that the inherent existing modern retailers globally can't use the same approach, right? Or maybe even a better approach. So which kind of seemed more like an opportunity and less of a problem to us. We felt that it's a pretty interesting play. E-commerce would definitely become a lot more serious in the overall penetration. This in 2016, like for a modern retailer, if you talk about, say, Big Bazaar, Hypercity, Mall, Shoppers Stop, e-commerce used to be less than 1% for these guys. But it was clear, say, 5 years down the line, it would become 10%, 15% of their revenues. So that's the bet we kind of took. And we wanted to kind of build the right technology which would help the offline guys go online in a very seamless way. Because I mean, by then, 2016 end is when we started Perfule. So 1 year into the journey, we were very clear that these guys are very, you can say, backward in technology. So the more we kind of help them adopt technology, build systems which would either help them reduce costs or increase revenue, they would adopt it pretty fast. And this would be a real differentiator for the offline retailers. They would adopt it and kind of become much better at their P&Ls, much better at their businesses, and kind of keep scaling it further. And that is when the market would become interesting, right? I mean, we want a lot of guys to stand up against Amazon, Flipkart, and kind of challenge them. So that is the aspiration with which we kind of went in the business. Understood that the industry is really backwards. So unless your technology is game-changing and priced at really low, they will not adopt it, right? I mean, this is a 30-year-old market. So they don't have a FOMO. They understand their businesses very well. And it's hard to penetrate. So you need to build a pretty interesting, solid product, charge it low because retail is a wafer thin margin business. So you can't have those fancy revenue products which would just scale and will be easy to adopt. So we understood that it's very challenging, but we kind of looked at other parallels, right? Look at payments. The way Pine Labs had scaled in the industry was a good example, and a lot of other SaaS retail global examples, which we kind of drew parallels from to chalk out our journey, our story. And we kind of did a lot of experiments to finally arrive at a product market fit.
Would love to hear a bit more about some of those experiments. Well, so first of all, how did you get your first few customers? Because I think with enterprise customers, that's always even more of a challenge. And then you spoke about experimenting to find product market fit. Again, would love to hear more about that because it's harder with bigger customers, right? It's not like you have thousands of customers to experiment with.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the first piece, I think what I can say is it's sheer persistence. So I mean, I personally was the sales guy, right, back in 2016 end when we were signing up these retail customers. So I literally had the persistence to reach out to CXOs of all retailers in the country. I had no idea, right, who would be my first customer. So I kind of worked backward. Look, these are the 30 top modern retailers who run 3,000 plus stores in India. These are my customers. I want to get all of them. I don't know in which order will I get them. I don't even know whether I'll get all of them, but I want to try. So I kind of started knocking doors of all of these guys, very simple email, LinkedIn reach outs. I think very counterintuitive, right? You generally think that CXOs of these large businesses wouldn't respond, right? They would get a lot of, you can say, such messages, such emails, and they wouldn't respond. But it works. You just have to be persistent. So I kind of made way into all of them. I think wrote to all 30 of them, followed up maybe 5-6 times. Over a period of 2 months, we were able to get 5 retailers from that engagement who did not say a yes, but they were happy to explore. So they kind of loved the passion and the place where we were coming from. They were excited that young people like us are taking interest to solve problems in a legacy industry like retail. So they were excited about the opportunity. They did not say a yes. They did not say a no. They said, okay, we'll explore. So that's the starting point. We kind of started pitching properly to these guys in terms of what we're building. And the first problem that we kind of attacked, like I said earlier, was we wanted to solve the problem of queues at checkout counters. So how can customers have a mobile app through which they can automatically shop, pick up any item on the shelf, scan the barcode of that item using the mobile app. Once they do that, add your items to the cart, make a digital cart, pay for it, get an invoice, and straight away go out of the store. The idea was that the customer doesn't need to go to a billing counter, doesn't need to wait for a cashier per se to bill them. They can do that complete transaction on the mobile app. This would ensure that the store kind of checkout counters get decentralized, and which would eventually solve the problem of queues, because no, you don't need the checkout counters anymore. All of this transaction can be done on the mobile app of the customer. There were certain issues around theft. How would we ensure that people don't take more than what they pay for, et cetera, et cetera. There were certain problems which we kind of tried to solve from a product standpoint. So that was the first thing that, I mean, me, Saket, okay, the three of us got together, built this basic product, the first prototype, and then kind of pitched very, very heavily to these guys, took them to their stores, gave them live demos. I think after that whole, you can say, persistent exercise over a period of 1 month, right? Because all of these guys were again based in Bombay. So I used to had to make like a couple of trips to from Bangalore to Bombay literally every week to finally show them the live impact. So I think all of that worked well. Eventually, Hypercity is the first customer who kind of said, okay, yes, I will kind of give it a shot. Then let's do a pilot at a few stores. So we kind of identified 5 stores, 3 in Bangalore, 2 in Bombay from Hypercity. And we said, okay, we'll run and let's see what happens. So that was the starting point in the journey of Perfule. And that, I think, it's the 0-1 moment for us, right? I think before that, it was all planning and no real outputs. At that point, we kind of went live with the first customer, started learning a lot more. So on day one, I mean, you always think, right, that you launch the product, customers would come, it's a good experience, they'll adopt it, but just doesn't happen. On first day, like me, Saket, Yogesh, all three of us in the store, like trying to get customers, like after like 6-7 hours in the store, we could get 10 customers to transact.
No one wanted to use it. People were just scared of it, or what was people's reactions, you know, when you go out?
I think people's reaction was quite interesting, but people were lazy. They were like, why should I download an app? Yeah. Give me a good reason to download an app. So I think, and that is a problem you can't even think of, right? Like you would never think, okay, this would be a problem. So, and more interesting challenges like that kept coming. So we kind of took those problems one-on-one, kept solving for them. But you're live. So I think once you're live, a lot more interesting journeys or interesting learnings come, right? You kind of map the complete customer journey. You understand where the pain points are. What can you do to improve that experience so that retention of the customers improves, et cetera, et cetera. So I think getting live is the most critical, you can say, part in the journey, because once you're live, that experience itself would give you the motivation to go further. So not giving up early on is the critical piece there. Once you're live, your customers, your, you can say, product would itself motivate you to kind of take it further. So this is October of 2016. We went live, kept doing this. I think December is when we got our first term sheet. March, the round closed, and the business started scaling from there on, right? I mean, we got a good team, got some 20-25 people in, started building the product, started kind of ironing out the overall bunch of things. By then had onboarded all the other customers. So I think March, April, we had around 6 retail customers and 100 stores on which we were kind of running this sales checkout solution. So things were kind of scaling well. And very early in our journey, we had no idea, right, about what are the critical metrics for this business. We came from very different backgrounds. All the entrepreneurs we spoke to who were actively helping us, none of them were anywhere involved in retail. So the key defining metrics, right, to help us judge whether we are in the right direction or not, we had no idea about it. But I think 5-6 months of journeys, we kind of started learning more about it, started benchmarking a lot more with the other retail startups. And then kind of after, you can say, a lot of, you can say, 7-8 months of effort into it, and the core metrics, like the high level vanity metrics, like the GMV, monthly customers, overall revenue, all of those were increasing. So we're like, okay, I must be good. Life is still, let's keep scaling more. Yeah. But we had no idea that there are certain core metrics, right, when you're building a consumer business. And the topmost one is retention. We had no idea for the first 8-9 months post-live that retention is important. So then I think somewhere in some conversation it came up. We went back, we had a lot of data stored in the system. We drew the retention cohorts for the first time, 8 months, 9 months post the go live. It looked horrible, like as bad as it can get. We had like 8% month-on-month retention, which is as pathetic as it is, right? And I think 5-6 sleepless nights, then did a lot of experiments to kind of kept improving it. From 8, it went on to like a 35 over another 6 months. But it's still not good, right? The kind of consumer product we were building, we should better be at 85, 90 plus. Because, and month-on-month retention, because shopping is an experience, it's a monthly experience. People would shop the same bunch of items month over month. So you better have 80, 90% retention if you're really trying to solve a problem. So that never, we threw money at it, we threw people at it, we tried every single thing that we could. We could just not get it over 35%. So then we understood that, look, what are we doing wrong? So then we went back to customers, did another 200 interviews to understand that why are they dropping off? So after that 200 customer exercise, right, personal calling, I myself did some 40, 50 calls over a period of 4-5 days. So got a very interesting feedback, did massive round of brainstorming with the team to understand there are certain inherent problems, and those problems are not in our product. So we kind of had, by that time, this is what, almost 1.5 to 2 years into our journey, we had really made the product experience very good, but customers were still not retaining. So we concluded that there are certain amount of bunch of problems which are not in our experience. They are problems in the retail store. Like, for example, if suppose the retail store gets new items in the store, those items would be deployed on the shelf, but would not reflect in their POS or ERP. If they don't reflect in their POS or ERP, it would not come to us as well. And then I can't give a seamless experience to the customer. So such problems kept happening, and they were the main reason for the drop-off. So another 1 month, we tried to build some solutions for all of them. We understood it's a pretty big overall exercise. Unless the core systems of the, you can say, retail store changes, unless they adopt a cloud-based ERP, a cloud-based POS, unless this whole technology takes a massive upgrade, any cool solution that we are thinking of, like self-checkout, would never scale. So we kind of took this problem statement, backed with crazy research, took it to the retail CEOs, and we told them, guys, we are doing a phenomenal job, but your systems are so bad that they just don't let customers retain. What do we do? So all of them, 5-6 retail CEOs in parallel, we are having this conversation. We got a very unanimous answer, which was again very shocking, and we had no idea about that till then. All of them said, look, Abhinav, this is interesting. We know this already. We know that our systems are bad, and you are not the only one who is suffering. Our e-commerce initiatives are suffering. Our CRM integrations are not happening. Our real-time offers engine is not coming. So I know this is not happening. So see if you can do something for it. All of them kind of said the same thing. So, and I think that's when, almost what, 18 months into a journey, we understood the problem we are trying to solve is not going to be solved unless this base product changes. So that's when we did the first pivot. And so I think the first product we focused on, it kept scaling, but we never found a product market fit. In our definition, product market fit would have only have been like a 90% plus monthly retention, which we never achieved after spending 18 months of effort and money and everything into it. That's when we pivoted. And we kind of said, we'll build an enterprise POS billing system for these retailers, which would help them get the technology, which would become the core operating system of the store. And it would be a cloud-based, very seamless solution, which would integrate beautifully with all of these new technologies, whether it's e-commerce or it's self-checkout or 10 more such initiatives, and make sure that a real technology upgrade of offline retail happens, which would eventually drive benefits to everyone. So we started thinking a lot more long-term. And that's when we kind of pivoted, took 6 months downtime, built this whole new POS product, very different from what we have built earlier, but a lot of learnings from those failures came in. We kind of built that whole product out, finded some core differentiators, because POS is a very legacy market. There were 400 plus POS players in the country. All of them were bad. So even if we build a good product, we need a good differentiator to go and, you can say, conquer the industry. So that's where we found a very interesting piece, which was very unique to us, which was around mobile POS. At the same time, Pine Labs, MSwipe, all of these companies were kind of upgrading. You must have seen there are card swipe machines in the offline stores. Pre-2017, 2018, all of them were, you can say, very independent, non-Android-based machines. So all of these companies, Pine Labs, Mosambi, MSwipe, at that point were upgrading those legacy card swipe machines into Android POS terminals. So basically, it would give an operating system to those card swipe machines. And that's where we saw the opportunity. We said, let's take our POS application and deploy it on the payment card swipe machine. What would happen is that payment machine, which was earlier taking only credit and debit card payments, would now develop as a full-fledged POS system on which you can do the complete invoicing for the customer, you can do catalog management, you can do everything that the store would need to kind of operate. That's a very interesting new concept. Nobody was kind of doing it by far in retail, although it was a very small niche, but came as a very good, interesting starting point for us. So we kind of built all of that for 5 months, I think, post the pivot. We launched this product, again, went to the same bunch of retailers, all of them said, yes, okay, we wanted. And I think the thing started looking much better from there. So initially, instead of one customer, we launched for 5 customers in parallel. After that, the hired sales guys stuff started scaling. Retention cohorts for a change were looking pretty good, like 99% plus retention. Enterprise SaaS products is a very different ballgame altogether. So applied all of them, things were looking much better. Went and did a series A round, raised more capital, started scaling further. Another year later, understood that, look, the market in India is limited. We need to go over because enterprise SaaS that too for a market like retail in India can't give you too much. It is a pretty slow evolving market. Go to other overseas markets. So did some more benchmarking on that, doubled down on Southeast Asia and Middle East, started scaling. And I think what, 8 to 9 months post the launch of international, it became almost 40% of our revenues and things started scaling from there on.
Understand. And I think that's a good segue into, you know, the acquisition by Amazon. Very few entrepreneurs are lucky enough to have any exit at all. What was the process like of actually, you know, deciding to potentially sell the company? It's your baby and, you know, it's not an easy decision, but would love to understand the process. And, you know, very few people actually see that it's not just something that happens overnight. It probably takes months, sometimes even years. So there's a long courtship phase and things like that. Could you walk us through that process? When did the conversation with Amazon start? And, you know, when do you decide that maybe it's better to partner with them rather than go it alone?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of things have to align for this to happen. So I think the story started back in October of 2018 is when we were raising our Series A. And at that point, I think there was enough noise about us in the market. So some other, not Amazon, some other company of that sort kind of reached out on that conversation. They were very impressed with what we were doing. And they said we would acquire this company and kind of integrate into our core roadmap and see how to leverage their capabilities to better build products for the offline retailers, offline merchants. That's when it triggered to me that, look, this is an interesting idea. Whether we sell or not is secondary, but these guys have a lot of resources. Why not figure out a way to leverage them? That's where the flywheel started. We had a pretty good Series A term sheet. We did not take that offer. Kept scaling further. But I understood this whole model, right? All of these large companies have a pretty active comp dev team. And either they will reach out to you, or if they don't, it's good for you to kind of reach out to them and be in touch with them. Because I think business is a lot about relationships. So you should always have the right relationship at the right place, because you don't know when in future you would need them. And even if you don't need them, it's always good to explore, because new initiatives, you can always align on, right? You leverage these others' capacities and kind of do better for the customer. So from that mindset, I started, and then pretty much got in touch with the corp dev of all the large companies over a period of 2 years, right? Build a pretty solid network, right? Knew everyone at these right companies. Some of them showed a lot of interest that we want to acquire, we want to do this, we want to fund this, that. But we were very clear that we will build this business. We will build this into a much larger business. And we had a very good support. I think Kalari and Prime were our lead investors. Venture Highway was always there, Neeraj and Samir. So they kind of helped a lot. And I think we always had decent access to financial capital. So that never became a challenge. It's why we were clear that unless financial capital dries out, and we were very early in our journey, right? Just Series A. There's no reason to raise money from a strategic, but always good to keep in touch and keep exploring common synergies. So over a period of 2 years, did some pilots with Amazon, did some pilot with a few other companies on certain aspects and certain, you can say, core areas. Some worked. I think majority of them failed. But over a period of time, people understood that, look, this is a solid company. They're trying to do something pretty interesting. That was the common understanding of the corp dev teams of all these large behemoths that we're talking about. So fast forwarding, I think things were going well. I would say till March of 2020, things were very good. March was our best month ever, I think. And the international was scaling beautifully well. So we were very confident that maybe triple our revenue by December 2020 and go raise a Series B, start looking at things in a very, very different lens. That's when COVID happened. And I think shocking what happened. And I mean, the kind of volumes that we used to see, right? Post 21st March, we were down to like 2% of what we used to do in terms of the overall transactions, overall active stores, everything. The whole country was shut, right? So nothing really was happening. So down to 2%. Recovery date started happening, I think, May onward when the lockdown opened up. But we saw that 30% of the stores were closed. And again, I'm talking about the large top tier retailers, right? They were just not finding it feasible to open the store because customer footfall was very, very limited. So 30% of these stores were closed. And even from the 70%, we were seeing like below 30-35% of the volumes that we used to do earlier. We were still hopeful that the vaccine would come, the recovery would happen, et cetera, et cetera. Fast forward to December, January of 2020, the volumes were still like below 50%. And in that whole point, we kind of did a lot more research to understand what is the recovery like? Would the recovery ever happen? So did a lot of consulting with many other folks to get an answer to that. Never find the right answer, but built enough knowledge to conclude that the market, again, when I say market, offline retail is massively hit and they would take a good amount of time to bounce back. And unless those guys get to their previous revenues, right? There's no way we would get to our previous revenue. And not just that, I mean, for a startup, it's very critical to keep growing, right? Unless you are like, say, tripling or quadrupling your revenue year on year at this stage we were, you would stagnate and you would not have the same velocity as a company that you were having earlier. So after all of those interactions, that this was the primary conclusion, that if it would take 3 years for offline retail to recover, that means like for sure 3 years stagnation for people as well. And probably much worse because they would try to cut down, retailers would try to cut down on costs wherever possible. And we were definitely a pretty decent cost center for these retailers. So that's where this all happened. And we understood. And at the same point, I think things, conversations with Amazon were kind of moving further on certain other aspects. And that's when they also offered that this looks interesting and we may want to partner. So we kind of went deep with them, spoke to the leadership in India, US, understood their vision because we always wanted to kind of join hands with the right partner, right? We didn't want to go somewhere where the overall mission, culture, etc. would change massively. We wanted to commit to the mission of making offline retail better. So I think when we listened to their vision, their aspiration, it was really impressing. And that's when we felt that, look, if there's one company which would impact the offline retailers, sellers, merchants, whatever you call them, it is Amazon, right? If you look at the kind of revenues they give to small businesses in India, it's crazy. It's sheer scale and expertise that they really have in the business. And when they're personally committing to even our type of business to help scale our type of business, I think that gave a lot of confidence. So we kind of went ahead with the conversations. Very interesting things happened. And then I think we felt this can be a good exit to the business, to the team, to the investors. Given the circumstances we are in, recovery was still far from happening. I think as of date of the acquisition, we were still like below 55% of what we used to do back in Feb 2020. So I think things did not magically change. Like if you look at food delivery, right, it came back to December, like February volume by December. That was not happening for offline retail and still not happening. So that's the primary reason why we chose to kind of join hands with a company like Amazon. We had a few other offers as well, but we found the right fit with Amazon, and which is why we kind of went ahead with it.
Amazing. No, thank you for walking us through the process. I think it's a very interesting decision, and you know, congrats on that. We'll conclude with the final question we ask our guests, which is, what's one piece of unfiltered feedback that you've received as part of your journey, and that's really stayed with you, made you change the way you think? You know, one piece of very honest, maybe even brutal feedback.
Let me think, what is that one? Because I mean, thankfully, I've been blessed with a very good bunch of advisors. All the names that I took earlier and a few more. So I think I have a very good support system of 15 entrepreneurs who really give me unfiltered feedback, literally. And it has been brutal many times. So thanks to that. But maybe I'll pick the most interesting one, I think, which was around self-checkouts only. So I think I wouldn't name who gave it, but came pretty brutally, right? So when we were doing self-checkouts, this is back in what, started in October of 2016. We kept doing self-checkouts till March, April of 2018. So during that period, right, towards the end of it, when we were thinking of a pilot, right, we were showing our retention cohorts to someone. And that someone really looked at it and kind of said, Abhinav, you have just wasted 18 months of your life. And then did some maths to explain what potentially I could have done in 18 months. It was shocking. So gave sleepless nights for a few months. But I think at that point, I was like really, you can say hurt, affected, whatever you call it, for a couple of days. But I think 2-3 days, I understood that, look, that person's intent was at the right place. And I should digest the, you can say, feedback, because it's for my good. I think that gave me a lot of conviction to do the pivot, because doing such pivots, right, from one product to just shut it down and try out another thing is quite hard. It's not easy. So I think that feedback was particularly, you can say a pretty big contributor in that whole decision of pivoting from self-checkouts to a enterprise SaaS POS sort of a product. Had that not happened, I think I would have still taken a lot more months to finally pivot. So sometimes, I mean, like it said, right, when, I mean, you have to take the medicine, right? It may just taste bad. There's nothing you can do. So I think, and many such instances, but this was by far the most shocking one. When someone shows you the value of 18 months, right, it's actually a lot.
Amazing. And I think taking that hard decision is easier said than done. I think the fact that you were able to take that decision helped you get to where you are today. So thanks a lot for sharing very transparently and openly, Abhinav. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Founders Unfiltered. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Join us next week for another episode of AJVC Unfiltered, where we talk about our latest piece.